or not, it would not make any impact whatsoever.
Saeed, a former law professor who was a political independent when elected president in 2019, dissolved the previous parliament. He started ruling by decree in July 2021, gradually amassing more power. In 2020, the president put a new constitution to vote that entered into force so he could overhaul the country's electoral system. President Saeed has defended these decisions, underscoring that the country had been on the verge of a civil war. The Tunisian president also defended last December's election as an important step towards a fully fledged democracy.
This is your historic moment. Don't miss the opportunity. Vote so you can get back your legitimate rights for justice and freedom.
However, the country's main opposition alliance is demanding that President Saeed resigns, claiming because voters overwhelmingly snubbed the legislative election.
I think that when it comes to opposition calls for Kais Saied to leave, I think what's important to note is that these elections were never about the Tunisian people. The reason Kais Saied held these elections was not for the Tunisian audience or not even for to renew legitimacy domestically. The whole purpose of the elections in Kais Saied's eyes was to offer an avenue for the international community to recognize his seizure of power, to recognize his new authority. A lot of the statements have been focused on restoring a democratic process, according to the various statements. What Kais Saied wanted was to offer an avenue through which the international community could say with a straight face that we see a democratic process in Tunisia. And Kais Saied achieved this, and we can see that in the White House statement that came out following the elections, which welcomed the elections as a step towards restoring the democratic process, despite the low turnout. So the opposition calling for Kais Saied to leave, I think it's important to note that the elections were never about Tunisians, it was never about renewing legitimacy, it was never about securing a mandate from the people. It was entirely about presenting an avenue through which Washington and the EU could turn around and say, we can now close the chapter on the parliament that was suspended because elections were held, however dubious they might be, and now we can work with Kais Saied and now we can recognize his authority. And if this was the aim of Kais Saied, then he succeeded. So it's irrelevant what the opposition says, at least according to Kais Saied.
The critics of President Saeed insist that the objective of the dissolution of parliament was consolidating a system of government run by one person with absolute power. However, Saeed has presented his actions as not only legal but necessary to save Tunisia.
Unfortunately, we are witnessing a coup attempt, but it is a failed one. The national duty requires today the protection of all the people and the homeland based on the articles of the Constitution.
President Saeed says all his actions have been taken for the interests of Tunisians. Do you agree?
I think when it comes to whether Kais Saied has been acting in the interests of Tunisia, whether he believes he is acting in the interests of Tunisia, I do think that this is a much more complicated question, primarily because Kais Saied, since he won the presidential election in 2019, a landslide election, bear in mind that he won the landslide because the Tunisians were rejecting the other candidate as opposed to supporting Kais Saied. Nabil Karoui, the other candidate, was considered associated with corruption, and so Tunisians wanted to vote against him rather than for Saeed. But irrespective, Saeed from day one made it absolutely clear that he wanted to rule the country directly. And in a country where the constitution makes parliament supreme and essentially doesn't give many powers to the president, this frustrated Kais Saied. And so he was in an open wrestling match with the parliament from day one in trying to appoint his own prime ministers while parliament was trying to appoint their own prime ministers. So I think there has been this wrestling. So the point being is that all of these measures that we've seen that are being taken have been primarily about Kais Saied seizing that power for himself, trying to essentially dominate the political scene.
Early January, a massive strike over pay by transport workers crippled transport in the Tunisian capital. The strike, the latest in a series of similar actions, came as the North African nation is currently struggling with debts of over 100% of the gross domestic product. Tunisia is also embroiled with a severe economic crisis amid frequent shortages of basic goods from petrol to cooking oil.
The reality is the economy is still spiraling. There are no policies that have brought about any particular change in the status quo in Tunisia, whether that's politically or economically. We've seen inflation, we've seen greater crises one after the other, we've seen the annihilation of the democratic process, and we see an increasing population that is increasingly despairing, and the numbers of those trying to cross what are called the boats of death across the Mediterranean are increasing. So therefore, when we talk about the interest of Tunisia, if Qais Saied was intending to defend and protect the interest of Tunisia, then he's certainly failing miserably. If his intention was to seize power for himself and dominate, he certainly seized power and he's certainly dominating. And the reality is that the situation now is worse than it has ever been.
The Tunisian president last July refuted any form of foreign meddling, affirming that Tunisia is a free, independent and sovereign country. He also extended from January 1st for 1 month the state of emergency in place since 2015. Now, why did the government of Tunisia extend the state of emergency again this month?
In terms of the state of emergency, I think it's important to highlight that Qais Saied knows that the economic situation is really bad at the moment. It's spiraling out of control. And Qais Saied now is realizing that the Tunisian population are having limited patience with him. And this is why we've seen moves in which he's sacked his trade minister as a result of the inflation, as a result of prices, as a result of the failure of tackling the economic crisis. There have been general strikes by the trade unions who supported his overthrow of the parliament and constitution, but who are clashing with him because they want to lead the process or the next stage as opposed to following Qais Saied. With the economy now really struggling, Qais Saied has declared a state of emergency as he tries to seek to maintain control and avoid any outburst of protest or any outburst of discontent that might threaten his rule or undermine his rule. So the state of emergency is primarily about preserving Qais Saied's power amidst this very difficult situation, which could well see, if there is any comparison with 2011, we're seeing in 2011 people took to the streets as a result of the economic crisis. Qais Saied fears that if he doesn't crack down on dissent very hard and doesn't take measures in order to prevent any gatherings, then it may well be that Tunisians will come out in the streets against him, not necessarily to restore the opposition, but just in this burst of rage that Qais Saied promised to make things better, and he hasn't.
Well, it's quite clear that the political situation in Tunisia remains fluid. We shall keep you posted as events unfold in this North African country. And we'll now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the uprising by Moroccans against the decision by the country's monarchy to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Stay with us.
Moroccans showdown with monarchy over Palestine.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Moroccan fans are seen here reaffirming their support for Palestine after their country's team claimed a thrilling victory over Belgium at the World Cup. To discuss the growing movement of Moroccans opposed to normalization of ties with the Israeli apartheid regime, we have contacted Abbas Hamide, a Palestinian activist and commentator. He's also the founder of Al Awda, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, during the just-concluded FIFA World Cup in Qatar, Moroccan players and fans became famous for raising the Palestinian flag in solidarity with oppressed Palestinians. Why is supporting Palestine important for Moroccans?
Well, I think there's been a long history with the Moroccan people in general, and of course Moroccan teams and Al Maghreb Al Arabi in general, who support the Palestinian struggle. So this is a very close bond that the Moroccan people have always had for the Palestinian people, you know, whether inside Morocco and even outside of Morocco. For example, when I hold rallies in Washington, D.C., we have a lot of Moroccan people from the Moroccan community in D.C. who come out. I think it's a very powerful statement. It's a solidarity that they've always had. And historically, I mean, the Moroccans came with Salah ad-Din to liberate Palestine, you know, during the Salah ad-Din era. So I think there's a very strong connection, you know, with the Moroccan people for Palestine.
Morocco's journey to the semifinals of the FIFA World Cup in Qatar is not just viewed as a national victory, but one for Africa and the entire Arab world, and in particular, a major boost for Palestinians. A Moroccan fan speaks here on the importance of players and fans raising the Palestinian flag.
Palestine's flag means a lot, especially at Qatar's World Cup. Here we feel that we can send the whole world a message, which is that Palestine will one day be free.
Despite the massive support for Palestine by Moroccans during the World Cup, the monarchy and Rabat is adamant on pushing the normalization agenda with the Israeli regime. The monarchy in Morocco is clearly bent on ignoring the voice of the masses.
Yeah, this is a very unfortunate situation where the monarchy or the kingdom of Morocco has always had ties, you know, to the Zionist entity occupying Palestine. I think this is, on a personal perspective, that's something very shameful of the Moroccan government to do, doing that. They've always had ties with the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and that's very unfortunate. But I think just like some other Arab governments or even some Muslim governments, unfortunately, the government does not represent its people, especially on Palestine. So while they're trying to continuously normalize with the Israeli occupation, that's something that's very shameful. And their people obviously do not reflect normalization. And we saw that at FIFA, at the World Cup, where Morocco obviously, you know, the Moroccan team, gloriously represented Palestine. They carried the Palestinian flag, you know, over their flag.
Moroccan fans led the world, and especially the Arab world, in raising the Palestinian flag during the World Cup in Qatar. A soccer fan from England who joined the movement led by Moroccans to raise the flag of Palestine speaks here on the reason for his solidarity with Palestinians.
Well, look, in this day and age, you know, you shouldn't bring politics into sport. I agree with that. Not the players, not the football itself. But I think we, as individuals, have a right to freedom of expression. And this is a great opportunity to show our solidarity with the Palestinian people.
How did the support for Palestinian liberation by football fans from across the world impact on the public opinion in Arab countries regarding the unpopular normalization deals being pursued by some Arab regimes?
Yes, absolutely. I think it reflected very well. It was a slap in the face to quite frankly, the United Arab Emirates in general, who continuously normalize, you know, with the Israeli occupation. I think that was a clear message from the Moroccan team. Also the fans, the Moroccan fans, fans from all over the world, quite frankly, not just Morocco, who were there waving the Palestinian flag. So I think that was a clear statement that the Moroccan people do not basically agree with their government. And it was a slap in the face to the United Arab Emirates in general, who obviously is normalizing with the Israeli occupation. So I think this was something courageous. I think this is something that reflects Arabs on the ground and not their government. So this was a slap in the face to all of them, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, to any Arab government that's seeking to normalize with Israel. This was a clear-cut slap in the face.
Morocco agreed in 2020 to normalize ties with the illegal Israeli entity under the so-called Abraham Accords that were brokered by the United States. As part of the deal, and in a departure from long-standing U.S. policy, then-President Donald Trump agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the disputed Western Sahara region.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa last year hosted Western Sahara President Brahim Ghali in Pretoria. During the visit, he stated that until the people of Western Sahara are able to exercise their right to self-determination, the decolonization of Africa will be incomplete.
Until the people of Western Sahara are able to exercise their own right to self-determination, the decolonization of Africa will be incomplete. As a country whose freedom was attained with the assistance of the international community and international support and solidarity, South Africa stands with the Sahrawi people in their struggle for self-determination.
The U.S. recognition of Rabat's claim over Western Sahara as the political border between Rabat and Washington led to the normalization with Tel Aviv.
I think it's going to prove futile, no matter what the Moroccan government seeks. And, you know, they're always extending their arms out. You know, we're talking about the leadership here and not the people. Whether they're extending their hands out to normalizing with the Israeli occupation, or whether they're extending their hand out to the United States for political gain and basically a green light from the United States as far as continuing to occupy the Western Sahara. It's going to prove futile because, you know, on the ground, it's a different story. There is a long-standing history between Morocco and the United States. I mean, the first country in the world to basically recognize the United States as a government was Morocco. So they have a long-standing history with each other. Unfortunately, the governments are corrupt in this case, you know, unlike their people. So I do believe that it will definitely collapse. It does not represent what's going on the ground. I do believe that, in general, the Moroccan people stand with their brethren in the Western Sahara.
The rift between the people of Morocco and the ruling monarchy is getting wider over the monarchy's normalization deal with the Israeli regime. A Moroccan speaks here during a protest to oppose his country ties with Israel.
This march today and all these demonstrations of the Palestinians is supported by several free movements around the world, in Europe, Latin America, the United States and Africa. This normalization must be stopped in our country.
Now, do you foresee the rift between the ruling monarchy and majority of Moroccans widening further until the normalization agreement with the Israeli regime is revoked?
Absolutely. I do see a rift widening between the Moroccan people on the ground and their governments, especially over Palestine, because it is not what the people wish. The people are, in general, you know, anti-colonization of Palestine. They're anti-normalizing with the Israeli occupation. And I think that the Moroccan people are ashamed of their government. I mean, I speak from firsthand experience with Moroccan friends, you know, who attend my rallies here in the United States. And they are definitely not happy with their government, you know, with their continued relationships between the government of Morocco and the Israeli occupation of Palestine. So it is only natural that that's going to widen. And it's only natural that eventually it will lead to mass protests. And that's what we hope for. We hope for all people, you know, around the world, in every Arab country, not just Morocco, But we are proud of the Moroccan people. We are proud of the Moroccans on the ground who do hold one of the largest protests for Palestine.
Well, there you have it. The rift between the people of Morocco and the ruling monarchy is set to widen and lead to more mass protests against the normalization deal with the Israeli regime. I'd like to thank our guest, Abbas Hamideh, for his analysis today. And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
The Arctic is getting rainier and seasons are shifting, with broad consequences for people, ecosystems, and wildlife. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in this regard, "In the Arctic, the freedom to travel, hunt, and make day-to-day decisions is profoundly tied to cold and frozen conditions for much of the year. These conditions are rapidly changing as the Arctic warms. The Arctic is now seeing more rainfall when historically it would be snowing. Sea ice that once protected coastlines from erosion during fall storms is forming later. And thinner river and lake ice is making travel by snowmobile increasing life-threatening. Ship traffic in the Arctic is also increasing, bringing new risks to fragile ecosystems, and the Greenland ice sheet is continuing to send fresh water and ice into the ocean, raising global sea level. In the annual Arctic report card released on December 13, 2022, some scientists were brought together to examine the current state of the Arctic system. It was found that Arctic precipitation is on the rise across all seasons, and these seasons are shifting. Much of this new precipitation is now falling as rain, sometimes during winter and traditionally frozen times of the year. This disrupts daily life for humans, wildlife, and plants. Roads become dangerously icy more often, and communities face greater risk of river flooding events. For indigenous reindeer herding communities, winter rain can create an impenetrable ice layer that prevents their reindeer from accessing vegetation beneath the snow. Arctic-wide, this shift toward wetter conditions can disrupt the lives of animals and plants that have evolved for dry and cold conditions, potentially altering Arctic people's local foods. when Fairbanks, Alaska, got 1.4 inches of freezing rain in December 2021, the moisture created an ice layer that persisted for months, bringing down trees and disrupting travel. Infrastructure and the ability of some Arctic animals to forage for food. The resulting ice layer was largely responsible for the deaths of a third of a bison herd in interior Alaska. There are multiple reasons for this increase in Arctic precipitation. As sea ice rapidly declines, more open water is exposed, which feeds increased moisture into the atmosphere. The entire Arctic region has seen a more than 40% loss in summer sea ice extent over the 44-year satellite record. The Arctic atmosphere is also warming more than twice as fast as the rest of the globe, and this warmer air can hold more moisture. Under the ground, the wetter rainier Arctic is accelerating the thaw of permafrost, upon which most Arctic communities and infrastructure are built. The result is crumbling buildings, sagging and cracked roads, the emergence of sinkholes and the collapse of community coastlines along rivers and ocean. Wetter weather also disrupts the building of a reliable winter snow pack and safe, reliable river ice, and often challenges indigenous communities' efforts to harvest and secure their food. When Typhoon Merbak hit in September 2022, fueled by unusually warm Pacific water, its hurricane-force winds, 50-foot waves, and far-reaching storm surge damaged homes and infrastructure over 1,000 miles of Bering Sea coastline and disrupted hunting and harvesting at a crucial time. Snow plays critical roles in the Arctic, and the snow season is shrinking. Snow helps to keep the Arctic cool by reflecting incoming solar radiation back to space, rather than allowing it to be absorbed by the darker, snow-free ground. Its presence helps lake ice last longer into spring and helps the land to retain moisture longer into summer, preventing overly dry conditions that are ripe for devastating wildfires. Snow is also a travel platform for hunters and a habitat for many animals that rely on it for nesting and protection from predators. A shrinking snow season is disrupting these critical functions. For example, the June snow cover extent across the Arctic is declining at a rate of nearly 20% per decade, marking a dramatic shift in how the snow season is defined and experienced across the North. Even in the depth of winter, warmer temperatures are breaking through. The far northern Alaska town of Ojiavik hit 40 degrees Fahrenheit, or 4.4 degrees Celsius, 8 Fahrenheit above, on December 5, 2022, even though the sun does not breach the horizon from mid-November through mid-January. Fatal falls through thin sea, lake, and river ice are on the rise across Alaska, resulting in immediate tragedies as well as adding to the culminative human cost of climate change that Arctic indigenous peoples are now experiencing on a generational scale. The impacts of Arctic warming are not limited to the Arctic. In 2022, the Greenland ice sheet lost ice for 25th consecutive year. This adds to rising seas, which escalates the danger coastal communities around the world must plan for to mitigate flooding and a storm surge. In early September 2022, the Greenland ice sheet experienced an unprecedented late season melt event across 36% of the ice sheet surface. This was followed by another even later melt event that same month, caused by the remnants of Hurricane Fiona moving up along eastern North America. International teams of scientists are dedicated to assessing the scale to which the Greenland ice sheet's ice formation and ice loss are out of balance. They are also increasingly learning about the transformative role that warming ocean waters play. This year's Arctic report card includes findings from NASA Ocean's Melting Greenland OMG mission that has confirmed that warming ocean temperatures are increasing ice loss at the edges of ice sheets.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, men's legal rights on wife. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the men's legal rights on the wife in the Islamic lifestyle. Well, when we talk about the rights of the man on the wife, the first thing that comes in the Islamic teachings is that the wife should not leave the house without the permission of husband. It is necessary because in the traditions of the Prophet ﷺ and the Quran, it is said that the wife should not leave the house without the permission of husband. Now, generally when we talk about such issues, it's been interpreted wrongly, and we need to have the true interpretation of this thing. When it is said that the wife cannot leave the house without the permission of husband, there is an exception, and the exception is except in the necessary time or the time where it is necessary for the woman to leave the house. For example, we can see in the Western culture, the wife is working and the man or like the husband is also working. So if she has to leave the house for the work, obviously she had the permission from before from the husband, so she can leave. Or maybe it's a grocery, or maybe there are other things which is necessary and the man or husband is not there. So therefore, in the necessary cases, she can leave the house. But if it is unnecessary, she should get the permission. And if the husband is not giving the permission, she should avoid leaving the house without the permission. Why? Because it builds the, obviously, if she's not leaving the house without the permission, it's building the trust amongst them. It's because the man who has the responsibility of running the house, the expenses of the house and everything, because according to the Islam, it is on the shoulders of the men, and he has to deal with everything which is outside the house and things which are inside the house, that is with the woman or the wife. Therefore, it is necessary to take the permission, inshallah. Welcome back. We were talking about the topic of the legal rights of men on the wife. We said that it is necessary that the wife should not leave the house without the permission of the husband, and except if it is necessary. And we gave the examples, for example, if the wife is working, if the wife is working, and she also has a profession where she has to leave the house. There is a pre-permission. There is no necessity of taking permission every time before leaving, because when there is a job, there is a work, she has to leave the house. The husband knows that she is going to the work. So in that time, it is not necessary. But on the other hand, unnecessarily going out, she has to take permission at that time. And we said that it brings the trust amongst the husband and wife. And obviously, this is a way to giving the importance to the husband as well when you take the permission. Same is the case on the other hand, when husband is going out, and if he does not tell his wife or the kids where is he going, everyone becomes worried about the person. Obviously, when husband is leaving the house without telling anything, we see that generally the wife quickly or immediately she calls the husband to ask, where are you? I'm worried about you. So it causes worries, unnecessary worries about each other. And obviously, this brings damage to the body, to the soul, to the spirit of the other person. So when we expect that the man, when he's leaving, he should tell us, he should inform us. Similarly, when wife is leaving the house, it is necessary to take the permission in order to have the best life, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Since 2007, the fabricated regime of Israel has banned any equipment access for the civil defense in Gaza. This issue has caused many problems for the residents of this blockaded enclave. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote in this regard, on December 18, 2022, a house fire in Gaza killed 21 civilians, including 10 children, all belonging to the same family. They were celebrating a birthday when the gasoline that they had stored fueled the devastating fire. This terrible accident left Palestinians in Gaza with a deep loss. They are still mourning, especially the people in Jabalia camp, where the family lived. When the house fire started, we heard people screaming. We rushed to help. The fire was raging, and there were a woman and her child trying to get out of the window as they were burning, said Muhammad Al-Khaldi, an eyewitness. Al-Khaldi added, "The window was closed with iron bars. They couldn't escape, and we couldn't help. Even though the metal gate to the building was closed, neighbors managed to break through. They rushed to the burning third-story apartment. The door was closed, airtight. They spent more than half an hour trying to break through to the apartment as they waited for the civil defense unit, which they had called to help fight the fire. When the neighbors reached the house, the fire was already intense. The smoke was severe. They could barely see, but they realized there was a big number of victims in one room." The civil defense arrived 30 minutes after the first call. Soon, they ran out of water and tried to get more water from a well in the neighborhood, which unfortunately was inaccessible because the electricity was cut off. The civil defense workers decided to bring water from another neighborhood. When they finally managed to extinguish the fire, everyone was found burned and dead. The civil defense confronts a huge shortage of equipment, Mahmoud Basal, spokesman of the civil defense unit in Gaza, told the Palestine Chronicle. Basal added, "Since 2007, Israel has banned any equipment access for the civil defense in Gaza. We face intense military escalations launched by Israel now and then. The situation here is very dangerous. We need an empowered civil defense." In 2007, the fabricated regime of Israel imposed a lockdown over Gaza, which has severely impacted people due to electricity cuts, water and air pollution, shortage of medical and civil defense equipment. Even though the recent house fire was not caused by an Israeli regime attack, Palestinians nevertheless blamed the Zionist regime for the civil defense weak and insufficient response. In fact, due to the hermetic Israeli regime blockade of Gaza and its harmful impact, civil defense in particular cannot perform its duties to the fullest extent. On May 16, 2021, the Zionist regime targeted Al-Wahda Street in Gaza City, leaving at least 44 Palestinians, including 18 children, killed. For about an hour, Israeli regime bombs rained down on the area. The homes eventually collapsed on the families living in them. With surrounding streets severely damaged, it was difficult for ambulances from the nearby Al-Shifa Hospital to reach the site of the bombing. Palestine rescue teams spent days pulling bodies from the rubble, dead and alive. "When there is a military escalation in Gaza, I don't go home," Mustafa Hamdan, a civil defense worker who witnessed the Al-Wahda bombardment, told the Palestine Chronicle. Hamdan added, "Do you know that there is no real international immunity for civil defense workers in Gaza? We sacrifice our lives for our people, but we desperately need better equipment. Our inability to do our job well is not a matter of laziness, but because we don't have adequate tools." In 2014, the Zionist regime bombed a civil defense vehicle in which Rami Daher, a civil worker, was killed in Ash-Shujaiya camp. Many civil defense workers were killed during previous intense Israeli assaults over Gaza while they were doing their work, Hamdan continued. When Hamdan reached Al-Wahda Street, it was full of rubble and destruction. He was horrified by the scene. It took him a while to grasp the shock and decide what to do. He said, "I needed a lot of civil defense supplies. I recall I needed modern bulldozers and sensors to know where the victims were. I was able to save a few people. I remember Shukri and Zainab Al-Kulak. I would have been able to rescue more had we had better equipment." In the latest assault over Gaza on August 6, 2022, the Zionist regime targeted a residential building in Al-Shut camp, a very crowded neighborhood. A few houses were entirely destroyed and many others were partially damaged. 8 Palestinians were killed during the airstrike. When the civil defense arrived, they managed to put out a house fire. Then, the civil defense could pull 4 injured women, 3 children, and 2 dead bodies from the rubble. They were actually digging with their bare hands. They couldn't continue that way and ask for a heavier bulldozer and more workers to come from the northern area of the strip to the southern, which takes approximately 2 hours. Meanwhile, they waited for permission from 2 of the neighbors to let them destroy their already damaged houses to make space for the diggers and bulldozers to drive through. With no hesitation, the neighbors agreed. Palestine Judah, an eyewitness, told the Palestine Chronicle, "After 2 hours, the heavy bulldozer reached the house. The civil defense pulled out the dead bodies. 2 of them died from lack of oxygen. They could have saved them, but the bulldozer arrived too late, and rescue equipment was not sophisticated enough to rescue the people. We need more workers. We need more sophisticated equipment to be able to rescue people," said Osama Abu Mohsen, a civil defense worker who participated in the rescue operation in Al-Shut refugee camp. Abu Mohsen continued, "If the world really cared about us, they could supply us with training and equipment. Unfortunately, the civil defense in Gaza confronts quite a huge shortage of equipment and training. In times of any aggression, assaults, or urgent accidents by the Zionist regime, we have to reach out to other institutions and organizations." The civil defense spokesman, Mahmoud Al-Basal, continued.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4th, 2023. If you have read the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was written about 200 years ago, they encouraged the black people to run away, and they would take them to the other side. Why? So that they could free them? No, it was because they needed cheap labor, cheap workers. It is the same method of deception used by the civilized gentleman in the West when dealing with various issues. There are many other such examples and similar cases. Therefore, they have truly harmed women in this case when they brought her into the workplace so that they could lower their expenses and pay her less money. Also, they believe men are the superior gender, so they decided that women should be used as a means for providing pleasure to men. It is actually very difficult for me to talk about this subject in any gathering, but especially in a gathering with the presence of the women. But this is their reality. What can we do? They did everything they could to convince women, and their value and worth was dependent on their behavior in trying to make themselves more sexually attractive to men. They did everything they could. It is a very sad story.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I have read many things in this regard. It is very difficult to talk about this. In one of the American magazines, which was shown to me around 7, 8 or 10 years ago, a very famous American businessman who owned dozens of beautiful, advanced, highly modern chain restaurants announced that he was hiring people. What type of people? He was hiring young girls and young women under the conditions that were written. One of these conditions was that the length of the dress of their skirt needed to be to a certain amount above their knees. They had even published a photo of how the women should be. You see, the plans they have for their businesses, for their industries, and for their everyday life in the streets is designed in such a manner to satisfy the desires of lustful men by way of the eyes or by other means. Well, they truly dishonored women.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Yemenis are growing frustrated with the United Nations' failure to condemn the Saudi-led war on Yemen or to hold them responsible for the ensued disastrous ramifications. This comes just days after the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, addressed the United Nations Security Council about the situation in Yemen. While calling for an end to violence, Grundberg declined to condemn the ongoing Saudi artillery shelling that has killed or injured dozens of civilians in the northern province of Saada.
I call on the parties to respect international humanitarian law. Military activity, combined with negative rhetoric and escalatory political and economic measures, create a situation where a simple miscalculation could reignite a cycle of violence that will be difficult.
Grunberg also called for humanitarian aid to Yemen, but mentioned nothing about the lifting of the Saudi blockade, which is the main obstacle preventing vital aid and food supplies from entering the country. This military general we spoke with on the streets of the Yemeni capital says the United Nations is the root cause of all evil in Yemen.
The UN destroys every country they get involved in. Look at what they did in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Sudan. As for Yemen, the United Nations and all of its envoys' efforts in Yemen have been directed at spying on Yemenis, instigating conflicts among Yemenis and fueling chaos and instability.
Some Yemenis are calling on their government to abandon all political talks with the UN. They accuse the UN of complicity with the Saudi-led coalition in the killing of Yemenis. The Yemeni government stated that if the blockade is not lifted and salaries are not paid, the only option left is war. The Yemeni people and government have expressed that the 8-year Saudi-imposed siege on Yemen must be broken by any means necessary. This after years of failed political efforts to resolve the conflict by the United Nations, an entity which most Yemenis lost trust in and accuse of supporting the Saudi military aggression on Yemen. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Tehran has hosted the first International Congress on Influential Women. The 2-day event is underway in the Iranian capital with the participation of influential, active and elite women from almost 90 world countries. Addressing the Congress, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi called on the participating women at the Congress to benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran with regard to women's rights.
We hope that the participants of this Congress, through cooperation and interaction, will be able to take necessary measures for the rights of women in the world and benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the field of protecting women's rights and paying special attention to women's role in the society. I hope this Congress will prepare the ground for further cooperation among countries in this field.
The event is aimed at identifying, supporting and developing the abilities and capabilities of elite and influential women at national and international level.
Women are suffering worldwide. This is just because we have not been together. And most importantly, this is the very first time for the Islamic country of Iran to host such a big occasion. So I am so happy to be here, and I hope the relationship with our sisters, women in the world, we should work hard, very strongly, and look forward to the international world to assist women than ever before.
It is extremely important to integrate women in peace building process. So this conference is extremely important because we know that we have peace threatened in many parts of the world. And when we look for solutions, women should be involved.
Special awards with international recognition are slated to be granted to influential women in 3 fields of science and technology, economic and social affairs.
The Congress International of the Women, it's very important for the women in the Islam. For the development, the communication, the country, for example, Algeria, the women Algeria and the women Iraq, and we take the relation very important because the Islam, it's number one.
The influential women have been selected from among housewives, women employees, female social activists, as well as competent women in digital technology, social media, science and technology, entrepreneurship, and those who are pioneers in areas of culture and charity affairs.
On the sidelines of the Congress, a memorandum of understanding was signed among Afghanistan's neighboring countries at the initiative of Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs to help Afghan girls and women continue their education. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The heads of the main EU institutions defended the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy during a debate in the European Parliament on Wednesday. They insisted that sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro, is the only way to thwart Russia.